Romney, and I approve this message.
The future of this country is more affected by the work that goes on within the four walls of the home than anything else. You teach kids about what TV to watch. You teach them how to read.
And that's how we raised our boys, is knowing that they were the focus.
It's just essential to have a home where faith, where love of country, where determination, where these features that are so much a part of America's culture are taught to our kids. And without that, I don't see how a society continues to lead the world.
That's an ad that's playing some places in the country from the Mitt Romney campaign. It's being called the pro-family ad, and golly, who can disagree with that? And Mitt Romney is such an engaging character. There's his wife alongside him. They've raised this big family. Now, yes, they're Mormons, but that's about as pro-family as you get. Welcome back to Issues Etc. It's audio open lines for the next half hour of the program. We'll hear that ad again and then some more news on Mitt Romney. A question I have for you that occurs to me upon hearing that, it almost has the same kind of appeal as the ads for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Do you think maybe that Mitt Romney's bid for the White House, the ads that will run, him being the kind of the public face of Mormonism for a while, will result in more people considering Mormonism? Will it be a boon to the Mormon Church to have Mitt Romney out there as the attractive, engaging public face of Mormonism, touting the family values that everybody says, look, if the Mormons have anything going, it's as long as they're not practicing polygamy, if they got anything going, they got the family values going. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Do you think it'll cause more people to seriously consider Mormonism? Issues ETC at KFUO.org, 1-800-730-2727. It's audio open lines. We're coming to you live this Tuesday, the 20th of November. Now, I said something before the break after our conversation with Tony Watkins on whether or not we should be reading The Golden Compass. Sometimes people misinterpret some of the things I've said about Harry Potter and Golden Compass. This is by no means, and none of these things should ever by any means serve as Wilkins' recommendation for these books like Harry Potter or The Golden Compass. What I said before the break was, and I spoke, I think, mostly to adult or semi-adult readers or people who might go see the movie. If you know going in what the author's axe is that he's grinding, you are well prepared not only to sit through the movie and engage the ideas it may present to you, but also to enjoy the movie as apparently the great story telling that it is. Now, if you can't get past the fact that the author is an atheist as an adult, fine, don't see the movie, don't read the books. That's fine too. Now, children are a different matter. Children are impressionable. But don't underestimate your kids. I was on a walk with my son last night, and I was asking him about his school day, as I often do, and he was going through his classes, and I said, what are you learning in social studies? His favorite teacher in social studies. And he said, well, I don't buy this because I'm a Christian, but we're talking about evolution. Now, he's 11 years old. He's in the sixth grade. I don't think I've had more than three words conversation with him about evolution in his whole life. But he knew enough as a young Christian boy to see that evolution was contrary to the Christian faith that he had been taught and to what Scripture teaches. And he said for himself, without Dad prompting him, I don't buy it because I'm a Christian, this evolution stuff. So we don't underestimate our children, but they're our children. We're there to protect them, and we should be cautious. So if you can't in good conscience guide your child through something like the Harry Potter novels or the Golden Compass, knowing where the author's coming from, then by no means should you. But if you're going to let them read them, you need to be reading them with them, just like you would with just about anything they consume. Well, they say that God dies in the Golden Compass story as the trilogy goes on. Guess what? In our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for November, God dies too. That's kind of the irony of the whole Pullman thing, is that God dies, and guess what? God dies in the Bible as well. And he rises again after 3 days. Jesus Christ, our Savior. It kind of has to happen for our sins to be put away. Our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for November is a Christmas book. And yes, that's why that baby, Jesus, came. He came as man and God to die in our place at the cross, and that is not lost in this book called What Happened to Merry Christmas. You can find out more about it at our website, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House and ask them about What Happened to Merry Christmas. It's a children's book, one that I can recommend that you can read to your kids. You know where the author's coming from, and you know that the truth is in there. Call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. It's the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for November, What Happened to Merry Christmas. Well, let's hear again this new family values ad by Mitt Romney's campaign. And as you listen, I want you to consider this question. Will Romney's run for the White House result in people taking a closer look at the Mormon faith, perhaps even positively? 1-800-730-2727, 505-7850, issuesetc at kfuo.org.
I'm Mitt Romney, and I approve this message.
The future of this country is more affected by the work that goes on within the four walls of the home than anything else. You teach kids about what TV to watch. You teach them how to read.
And that's how we raised our boys, is knowing that they were the focus.
It's just essential to have a home where faith, where love of country, where determination, where these features that are so much a part of America's culture are taught to our kids. And without that, I don't see how a society continues to lead the world.
Hard to disagree with Mitt Romney when he talks about the future of our country having to do with what happens between the four walls of a home, or that the family really is the basis for a country's future, or that, I guess to use a cliche that became popular in the 80s, I believe that children are the future. It's kind of a obvious statement. I'm certainly not the future, but my kids will be around after me. It's a very positive message. It reflects well on Romney as a candidate and as a Mormon candidate for president. So will his presidential run result in more converts to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints? People who had been kind of observing it from afar said, now, wait a minute. I kind of like the message that Romney's putting out. Maybe that message comes from his Mormonism. Maybe I should consider it. Issues ETC at KFUO.org, 505-7850, or 1-800-730-2727. You had something you want to say?
I was just waiting for you to...
Jeff is the big... All Jeff can talk about lately is Mike Huckabee. That's all he wants to talk about.
I'm starting to come around to Mike Huckabee. Brother,
would you consider
my brother's been, you know, brainwashing me for the last 2 months, and the more I watch him, the more I like him. But I want to get back to this Romney thing. I mean, the ad, if anybody's seen the ad, it looks like just the slickest ad that you see from the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I mean, it is well done. It's either that or it's your it's an ad for your mega church, non-denominational church in town with the same message.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Okay, so aside from the fact that Romney is not yet willing to kind of step up to the podium and really talk Mormonism with the public, he's made some noise that he might be willing to do that if need be. Others are raising the subject. We'll hear about that in just a moment. In some surveys or some push polling that's being done via telemarketing, he's putting his best face forward. And in doing so, someone might argue he's putting Mormonism's best face forward. Will it result? One of the unintended consequences of having a very attractive, engaging, and likable Mormon running for the presidency, will it result in perhaps more converts to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints? 505-7850. 1-800-730-2727, issuesetc at kfuo.org. Next up here on Audio Open Lines, Issues Etc., a Fox News story about that push polling being done. Romney says it's anti-Mormon.
Somebody's been slinging mud at Mitt Romney's Mormon faith and won't admit it. A feeding frenzy is unfolding on the campaign trail to identify who's paying for so-called push polls. Telemarketing surveys disguised as regular polls that raise loaded questions about the validity of the Book of Mormon versus the Bible, and about Romney's Vietnam-era draft deferment because he was doing his Mormon missionary work.
The idea that people would attack religion at a time like this is, frankly, un-American.
With his faith under fire, Romney's debuting a new ad emphasizing family values.
The future of this country is more affected by the work that goes on within the four walls of the home.
The push-poll telephone calls against Romney's Mormon faith have not been caught on tape. People who've received them say they've included favorable information about John McCain, and that's cast suspicion on him. He adamantly denies involvement.
My leadership team in New Hampshire is filing suit in the New Hampshire with the New Hampshire Attorney General over the fact that there is these so-called push-pull polls that are out there that are alleging using my name and making scurrilous comments about Governor Romney and his religion.
In a bit of reverse political logic, some suspect Romney's supporters. A few donors to his campaign work for a Utah-based telemarketing company called Western Watts that does political telemarketing but denies push polling. Romney denounced the suggestion that his backers would do this to inoculate him against religious bigotry and thus make him seem like a victim.
It's not very likely that people who support my campaign are going to launch calls attacking me on the basis of my faith. So I think that's kind of remote.
Campaigning at the Ford 400 NASCAR Championship race this weekend in Florida, Rudy Giuliani also denied involvement.
I think there is no religious test for office in this country. And to raise anyone's religion is wrong. It's un-American. It's not the right thing to do. I have no idea who's doing it. I guess nobody has any idea who's doing it. Who's ever doing it should stop it.
Fred Thompson's campaign also issued a statement denying any role. The whispered speculation does not cast suspicion on him so far. Mike Huckabee's campaign issued a statement saying that they do not condone such calls. Critics call that a non-denial denial compared to others. The calls are occurring in Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina. Huckabee is in second place to Romney in Iowa. And late this afternoon, the Huckabee campaign issued to Fox News an emphatic denial, saying that it has done nothing and knows nothing about these calls. The Attorney General in New Hampshire is now conducting an investigation, so it's likely to be found out who done it. And also in New Hampshire, there is a new poll out showing that the race has changed again among Republicans. Mitt Romney has jumped back into a strong lead, now at 33%. John McCain has moved up several points into second place with 18%. Rudy Giuliani has dropped by 8 points since the last time this poll was taken a few weeks back. He's now at 16, and Ron Paul is beating Fred Thompson. Not a good survey for Thompson, Brett.
All right, there's the story from Fox News. A little bit of everything in there. The Romney ad as a response, if it is a response to the push polling. No one knows who's doing it. It really doesn't make any difference. It's had its intended effect, and it looks like the Romney campaign is making the best of it. Sometimes this is the best advertising you can get, being able to respond to some harsh criticism, especially when it has to do with his Mormonism. Do you think that Romney running for president will cause, and all the media attention that's being given to Romney and his Mormonism, do you think it will have the result of more people taking a closer look at the Mormon faith? 1-800-730-2727, 505-7850, issues ETC at KFUO.org. It's audio open lines. Mark is calling from his car. Hi, Mark.
Hi. Nice to talk to you. Mitt Romney and his Mormon faith. It seems to me that that seems to be a secondary issue when examining a candidate for president. let me gather my thoughts. The primary issue of among many, as I understand it, is how does Mitt Romney treat the Constitution? And a very telling example happened to this in one of the debates. Mitt Romney, among others, was asked by Tim Russert, the interviewer, whether or not Congress needed to go to the president to ask for war or to ask permission for a war or something of that nature, and he responded, "Well, we'll let the lawyers deal with it." And Ron Paul's response was, "I'm flabbergasted. All we have to do is read the Constitution." So, I mean, the issue for me is that the Constitution sort of norms the discussion, but for many of the candidates, Democratic and Republican, it doesn't. And I wonder if we should look there first and put his Mormonism on the back burner. What do you think of that?
All right, Mark, thank you very much. I can only express my personal opinion here when it comes to something like a Mormon president. I obviously have deep theological concerns about Mormonism and the errors that it espouses. I'm concerned about Mormonism that it's trying to pass itself off as mainstream Christianity, sometimes with the complicity of mainstream evangelical Christians. I'm not so concerned about having a Mormon in the White House, to tell you the truth. I'm more concerned about where Romney stands on the issues that I think are most important to this country when it comes to whether or not he's qualified to be president. So I'm not personally too concerned about it. That's my personal opinion. Now, Romney might do something to spook me, but at this point, his Mormonism, I would agree with you, is a secondary issue. But not for everybody. And certainly not for, at least it appears, certainly there are still people who are not only uneasy with it, but still holding their breath, waiting to see what's going to happen with Romney if he's successful. They're going to, I think people will have to answer this question. The question I do, that I continue to have is, what will this do for Mormonism? I mean, Romney may come and go, but here's the first high-profile and so far very positive image of a Mormon that's been before us for a long time. In a time when Mormonism has kind of taken a hit because of guys like Warren Jeffs, will it cause more people to think, you know, maybe those Mormons aren't as crazy as I always thought. Maybe what those Christians have been saying isn't true, and maybe it's a perfectly legitimate faith to hold.
It's not the first in a long time. Remember, Orrin Hatch ran recently for president, senator from Utah.
Well, what I'm saying, with the first that has this almost Reagan-esque positive Americana feel to it. You can't even hear Mitt, and this is, again, just my personal opinion, you cannot hear Mitt Romney utter a word without thinking, wow, that guy sounds like he has something important to say. He's got the whole package. Everybody says he's like ordered from central casting for the presidency. If he weren't running for president, he'd probably be cast as president in the next movie that includes the president as a character, because he looks the part. He sounds the part.
I think Gina Davis looks better personally, but you got to admit, the guy is good looking.
He's got the whole package going. He really does. And you put him next to, I mean, I like Fred Thompson a lot, but you put him next to Fred Thompson, the beauty contest begins.
I threw that editorial comment in there only for this purpose, because yesterday, to redeem myself saying that Eddie Van Halen looks better than you and I, you mm-hmm. and me, Charlie showed me. I got Eddie Van Halen mixed up with the Bon Jovi guy.
You think John Bon Jovi looks bad?
No, he looks great. But yesterday, remember I said Eddie Van Halen looks worse than you and me. Yeah. How come he?
How can you get?
Or looks better than you and me? How? But then he showed me a picture, Charlie, yesterday. Oh, my goodness, Eddie Van Halen. He
how
looks like.
How can you get John Bon Jovi mixed up with Eddie Van Halen?
I don't know. They're all the same.
Two different eras of rock and roll. Although I saw him hosting Saturday Night Live the other day. It was a rerun, and my daughter said the guy's had work. He has to have had work. No one looks that good, John Bon Jovi. No one looks that good at his age. I think he's about my age. He might be a little bit older. No one looks this good. So he had to have had work. My daughter can detect these things somehow. All right, so enough of that excursus. You got it completely off the rails.
Nobody's calling in, which I think is a very good question. Will his run, or maybe it could hurt the Mormon faith? What if they find out some kind of scandalous issue in his past? You know, and since Mormon is predominantly a religion of morality, maybe the whole thing falls like a house of cards. I don't know, but I think it's a really good question you're posing to the listeners.
Well, I think another question that goes along with it is, when will Mitt Romney come clean on the Mormonism issue? Let's say that this is the peak of his polling and he goes away. He'll never have to come clean on it. Fine. But let's say he makes it through the first couple rounds of the primary season. He's polling very well ahead of the rest of the people in some of those first states. The closer he gets to the White House, the more and more urgent it becomes that he deal with the issue of Mormonism, because he got 4 years, potentially, to sit in the White House, and those 4 years will mean it's going to come up again and again and again. So should Romney come clean about his Mormon faith, address it absolutely in a straightforward, head-on way, talk about being a Mormon, not just talk about being a man of faith or a man of family values. Should he address it? Other people are asking the question. A little bit later in Audio Open Lines, we'll play a piece for you. I think Ari Fleischer, if I'm not mistaken, had a few pieces of choice advice for Mitt Romney on the whole religion issue. 505-7850. 1-800-730-2727 or our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org, issuesetc@kfuo.org.
I think after watching that ad, and if you've seen the ad, it's very powerful. I think it will, more people will take a closer look. I'm not taking a whether or not Christians should vote for a Mormon. That's immaterial to me. But
okay, let's think about it this way. All those seekers out there that we're always hearing about, all those people who are spiritual seekers, they're portrayed as spiritually neutral. They're just out there soaking it up, trying to figure out what direction they want to go in life. And they know that secular humanism is a dead end, but they don't know what form of spirituality they really want. We're told that all the huddled masses out there in society and our culture are essentially seekers after God in some form or another. So let's just say, for the sake of argument, that that's true. It isn't, but let's just say for the sake of argument that it's true. The average person who would be swayed to go to the local big box church where it's pretty much a feel-good kind of happy experience. You go in, you sing some songs, you hear a little bit about God and a lot about yourself, and you walk out just feeling that much better about who you are and where you're headed in life, and you feel like you've had a spiritual experience. The big box megachurch. The person who's going to find that interesting, aren't they also at the same time going to find Mormonism interesting?
If you watch that ad, you'd say, boy, I wish my family were like Mitt Romney and his boys and his wife.
Maybe Mormonism, maybe it's the key to Mitt Romney's happy family life. And that's what I want. And maybe it's the key to his great vision of America. And that's what I want. And maybe there's a reason why all those Mormons seem so happy. Maybe it is they really are. Boy, talk about a religion that'll give you a purpose in life. Talk about a religion that'll tell you where you're headed. We heard when Rick Warren's book, The Purpose-Driven Life, came out, we heard from one of our colleagues that when they were sitting around for the holidays, her Mormon brother,
used to be Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.
Yeah, her Mormon brother said, held up the purpose-driven life and said, if you guys want to know what Mormonism is really all about, read this book by Rick Warren, The Purpose-Driven Life. Now, that would be an endorsement for Mitt Romney. Rick Warren, that would be an endorsement. They seem to have an affinity for one another. So the person who's out there looks at Rick Warren's book, says, wow, this is the kind of life I want. Mitt Romney says, hey, I'm living it. And look at all my Mormon brethren out there. They're living it too. A high-profile, positively portrayed Mormon running for president. Will it make Mormonism more popular? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, or issuesetc@kfuo.org. We can take that question up again when we revisit audio open lines in the last segment of Issues Etc. at 5:30. When we come back, Greg Kokel is going to join us. We're going to talk about the problem of evil. He's president and CEO of Stand to Reason. Stay tuned.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Due to the Thanksgiving holiday this week, programs on Thursday and Friday will be repeats. We are therefore moving Open Line Friday to Open Line Wednesday. You can phone in on any topic or comment you wish to talk about. Even if you have no plans to phone in, the callers may touch on a subject of your interest.
Listen to Law and Gospel weekday afternoons from 1 till 3 on AM 850 KFUO. AM 850 KFUO salutes our day sponsor on this Tuesday, November 20th, 2007, a friend at Christ Memorial Lutheran Church. Today's day sponsor has made a contribution to AM 850 KFUO. Once again, we say thank you to our AM 850 KFUO day sponsor, our friend at Christ Memorial Lutheran Church.
Music. This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. Cohabitation is increasing, and it appears kids are getting the short end of the stick, literally. Child abuse in America is at an all-time high, and experts warn the alleged perpetrators are often live-in boyfriends of the child's mother. Josh Montes has more on the disturbing trend dubbed the abusive boyfriend syndrome.
If you open the door to a non-traditional family structure, don't be surprised if an abusive agent walks in. Reports show children living in households with unrelated adults, usually their mom's boyfriends, are 50 times more likely to die of inflicted injuries than children living with their biological parents.
The demographers estimate that a child who's born out of wedlock will have something like 5 or 6 different father figures and co-resident in their household or in their mother's life before the age of 16.
That's Robin Wilson, Washington and Lee University professor. She says while family situations vary and not all non-traditional forms lead to abuse, single moms ought to challenge their boyfriend's motivation to move in.
They may be there because they want to be in the mother's life, but not necessarily the child's life. And they may see the child as a threat to how they want to interact with the mother or forming a new family.
University of Virginia professor Brad Wilcox says men often step into father-like shoes they are not ready to fill. That's usually where abuse or neglect prevails.
It's a very simple idea, and it's an idea that's actually quite old, but I think we actually have to be really attentive to the kinds of adults that, you know, we're putting in contact with our children.
Research from the University of New Hampshire shows kids living in cohabiting households are at greater risk of being sexually abused. For Family News in Focus, I'm Josh Montes.
According to census data, 30 years ago, nearly 80% of America's children lived with both parents. Now, only 2/3 of them do. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
Do you want more of God's grace? Christ Our Savior Lutheran Church in Freeburg, Illinois is a Bible-believing church faithful to the Scriptures, a place for the whole family, a community that cares with a vibrant, historic Christian liturgy. Christ Our Savior Lutheran Church is located at 612 North State Street in Freeburg. Their phone number, 618-539-5664. Christ-centered, cross-focused, Christ Our Savior Lutheran Church in Freeburg.
You can share the real meaning of Christmas with your young children and grandchildren in our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for November titled, What Happened to Merry Christmas? It's published by Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. Or you can find out more about this new children's book at issuesetc.org. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for November, What Happened to Merry Christmas?
Just ain't right. That's evil.
We talk about the problem of evil here on Issues Etc. Greg Kokel joins us for the next half hour of the program. Some people say it's the proof that God doesn't exist because there's evil, big evil, in the world. Issues Etc. is underwritten in part locally by Concordia University St. Louis Center, where classes are designed to meet your busy schedule. That's one night a week. You can pursue your associate's, bachelor's, or MBA there at Concordia University St. Louis Center at 44 and 270. Find out more about them under the What's New section of our website, issuesetc.org. Click What's New or give them a call, 314-984-8840. 314-984-8840, Concordia University, St. Louis Center. Greg Kokel is a regular guest, president and CEO of Stand to Reason, based in Signal Hill, California, author of a recent article on the problem of evil for the Solid Ground newsletter. Greg, welcome back.
Hey, nice to talk to you, Todd.
Well, the latest is this terrible cyclone in Bangladesh.
Yeah.
Over 3,000 dead, many more displaced and injured. A terrible blow to the people there, to the economy, to families. Someone watches that news and says, there it is. There is no God. Mm-hmm. There can't be when this kind of stuff just happens. Your response?
Well, nothing like hit me with the hardest question imaginable right out of the gates here, Todd. This is a tough, challenging issue to deal with. And like a lot of things in life, there isn't going to be an answer, I think, that's going to satisfy everybody. And especially the most difficult kind of issue of, pardon me, the problem of evil, are these kind of acts of God, as it were, that take tremendous amount of innocent lives. And then we wonder, where was God? How could God exist if he's good and he's powerful, and yet these things still happen? And I think for many aspects of the problem of evil, there are tidier answers. I think this aspect, what might be called natural evil, is one of the most difficult for followers of Christ and theists in general to deal with, Todd. And I'll tell you the way I go about this. I mean, there are a couple of ways of talking about this. I mean, some would argue that if the world wasn't fallen by man in the first place, then there wouldn't be things like typhoons and tornadoes and tsunamis and those kinds of things to begin with. I'm not entirely satisfied with that answer. But here's the way I go when it comes to natural evil. I say, which worldview gives us the best resources to deal with problems like this? It's going to be very hard for me, Todd, as a theist, to say, well, I know why God allowed this act of evil in this circumstance, because I don't know that. And nobody does. God hasn't told us why he allows any particular disaster, catastrophe to happen that takes people's lives. But I ask myself, what are the alternatives in dealing with something like this? The way you pose the question, people are kind of opting for atheism as the alternative. And they're saying, well, see, this must prove that God doesn't exist. And my response is, well, that actually seems to create more problems than what I'm faced with. And I think it's best characterized by a comment that Bertrand Russell, the great philosopher of the 20th century, said with regards to this problem. Now, he was a deeply committed atheist, wrote a book entitled Why I'm Not a Christian, and this was one of the problems he brought up. And one of the things that Bertrand Russell says is, how do you talk about God when you are kneeling at the bed of a dying child? Now, that's similar to the illustration you brought up a moment ago, Todd. This is a compelling, powerful image, and the question has great rhetorical force until you think of the response that William Lane Craig offered to Bertrand Russell. And what he said was, what is Bertrand Russell, the atheist, going to say when he's kneeling at the bed of a dying child? Tough luck? That's the way it goes? Too bad? But you see, that's all that he's left with. And so when I come to challenges like these, Todd, part of the way I answer the question, since I can't answer the question, why did God allow this act of evil right here, I ask myself, which worldview has the best resources of dealing with it? If atheism is really true, if atheism is what we conclude from things like typhoons, then we are not able even to say of the typhoon that it is an evil or tragic event. We just got to say it's just stuff happening. That's the way it goes when molecules clash in the universe. There's no meaning, there's no substance, nothing. But if God is in the picture, even if there are things like typhoons and tsunamis and earthquakes and devastating fires like we had here in Southern California, at least there's the possibility, even though we can't explain all of the particulars, at least there's the possibility for the circumstances to be redemptive. That is, God can take the tragic circumstances and turn them into something good. Now, I realize that's not going to be satisfying to everybody, at least not to the natural evil question, Todd, but I think we have to look at this not just as theists or Christians answering the question, but this is a problem everybody's got to solve. And who's got a better solution? The atheistic solution is no better. In fact, it's much worse. He's got to make sense out of the problem of evil, too. He's got to explain why the problem of evil is tragic for human beings. He also has to make sense of the problem of good, which we don't have to face. Where do you get good in the world? We understand that from a good God who grounds morality. So sometimes the way to answer this is to look at the options and see which is the best option. I think that Christianity provides the best kind of answer for this thorny problem.
Now, you've done something there, and I want to make sure that our listeners are on board with this. Really, when we talk about evil, in that philosophical sense, we're talking about two different things. You've mentioned one, what you've called it natural evil, or
right.
just bad things that appear, things that appear to be bad that happen.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's also moral evil. When someone poses the problem of evil, Greg, which one are they more often talking about? Bad things that happen, or that there are bad acts in the world?
Well, it kind of depends on what's in the headlines, Todd. When you're having, like, just the rank-and-file non-believer, atheist, whatever, talking with you about your Christian convictions, normally the problem of evil comes up kind of in the abstract. Why does a good God allow people to do evil in the world? So there's rapes and murders and pillagings and wars and explosions and terrorist activity. And these are the particular kinds of things that people are pointing to when there's when they're trying to raise the objection. There, it's kind of an intellectual thing, and that is probably the garden variety of objection on the problem of evil. Since there are evil people in the world, then how could God allow people to do those evil things? However, it's much more visceral when something terrible happens, say, in the natural realm. And then it is a different kind of response. Then people are responding somewhat intellectually. That is, they see there's a problem, but their emotions are deeply involved here, which makes it a trickier thing to deal with. It also points out, I think, this distinction that you've pointed out, that I've made, actually, is it points out another thing, that there are sometimes we can give, I think, crisp answers to challenges that are raised. There are other times the answers are not that crisp. I think the problem of natural evil is one of those. I think it's hard for us to really make sense of all of the natural evil in the world when taken in isolation. And this is why I kind of drop back and choose a different strategy. And my strategy acknowledges the fact that life is messy and not, a lot of times perfect answers are not forthcoming. But then I have to ask myself a different question. Then what are my alternatives? Well, I could say there is no God. I could say evil is an illusion. I could say there is no good and evil ultimately in the world. It's just molecules clashing in the universe, and there's no value judgments that are of any kind that can be made. But then, of course, one wonders how to make sense out of the objection initially that we come viscerally and respond to these things, and they seem to be tragic. They seem to be wicked in some certain sense. And so it strikes me that those alternatives are not as good as the Christian alternative. So my strategy in dealing with this issue, Todd, is to point out what is the most reasonable alternatives, given the alternatives that we have. And even if Christianity can't produce an answer for every question, it seems to produce the better answers than the other alternatives in this particular case.
Well, I guess that raises the question, and often Christians feel as though they bear the burden of proof here, or bear the burden of explanation here,
yeah.
that, gee, if I'm a Christian, I have to be able to explain why God did this, or
uh-huh.
what he was thinking when he did that or permitted that, and I got to be able to explain it all to everyone's intellectual satisfaction.
Right, yeah, I think there is a burden that's legitimate that the Christian bears in a certain sense, but I think we also have to be reasonable with ourselves with the kind of answers that we have at our disposal. I mean, we can't always know the mind of God in every circumstance. And so I think it's fair for a non-believer to say, how can you make sense out of all of this evil if your God is really good? And what I'm saying is, I think we can make some progress in that. We talk about human evil. We can talk about a fallen world that wasn't the way God intended it. Evil is an imposter here. It's an intruder, rather. It wasn't part of the original plan. Something happened to turn things sour, as it were, in the world. And now it's a cleanup act, and God is working with us to clean things up. So I think we have some burden of proof to try to explain it as far as we can, but I think when we run to the limits of our explanation, because we don't always know the mind of God for every incident of evil, I think it's fair to say, what are our options? Sometimes I ask the challenger, I say, well, what would you do? What do you think the answer to the problem of evil is? You think there's real evil? Well, if there is real evil, you're going to have to ground that some way in an objective standard of good, and that seems to suggest God existing to make sense of that good, of which evil is a departure. And if you want to say, well, there is no God, it's just naturalism and the laws of nature, and that's the end of it, then no value judgments of any kind are going to work. You can't answer the problem of evil because there is no problem of evil. But that has its own difficulties. That's like saying there's nothing in the world that's evil. But the fact that these things cropped up in the first place was what raised the question. You know, that looks like evil to me, that tsunami or whatever. Then how do you explain it? So I keep kind of going back to this as a fallback position when I want to say to somebody else, well, how would you explain it? Can you come up with a better explanation? At least in Christianity, we have the confidence that there is a good God who's running things and who can redeem evil for good. We're not just the victims of it.
Now, you say that the classic problem of evil and the argument that is made usually by atheists, since the world seems fraught with evil and injustice and unfairness, God cannot exist. You say that this is really more an argument for the existence of God. Walk us through it step by step. How does the problem of evil actually argue more strongly for God's existence than against it?
Okay, the observation that is made is that there is something like objective evil in the world. Now, so I hope your listeners, I'm sure they can see that a relativist can't help himself to this objection, first off, because he doesn't believe in objective evil. The nature of the objection is there are really bad things out there going on, so how could a supposedly good God allow it? And I asked them, what do you mean by evil? And of course they're going to give the illustrations that we just talked about, rape, pillaging, etc. And I said, no, you've given me illustrations of evil. I want to know why you call those things evil rather than calling something else evil. Why would you call Hitler evil rather than Mother Teresa? Why would you call raping evil instead of acts of kindness? And that, I think, gives people pause, because now they realize that they have in their mind something that shouldn't be the way it is, something that falls short of a larger standard. Sometimes I use the illustration of bowling, Todd, and I ask people, how do you know a good bowler from a bad bowler? Well, what people tell me when I ask audiences this is they think about it for a moment, then they realize, well, the score, it isn't his form, it's how many pins he knocks down. So in order for there to be good or bad, there has to be a reference point that defines what is good and what is bad, a scoring system. So when we say that there's evil in the world and we identify some things as evil, it's as if we're saying, well, they get a low score on the good scale. Okay? Now here's the question. I mean, I think all that's common sense when you think about it a little bit. Yeah, that's what we're talking about in a sense. Now here's the problem. Where did the scoring system come from? Where is that thing? What determines the standard of good? When I say what determines it, I don't mean how do we figure that out, because I think most of us already have that built into us. I think what is it that makes the world a place where there's a standard of goodness to begin with? What that's called the grounding question. Why is the world the way it is, or why is this thing the way it is? What makes it that way? We can observe gravity, but why does gravity work the way it does? And in the same way, we can observe morality, this code of right and wrong that allows us to define evil, recognize evil, but why does such a code exist at all? And I've written about this in the Relativism book towards the end. It's going to be difficult, I think, for anyone to make sense of real morality without having a moral person to whom we are obliged, who sets the standard in some significant way. And this is the way C.S. Lewis argued, by the way, in his wonderful little book, Mere Christianity, which is must reading for every follower of Christ. Excuse me, it's well written and easy to follow, and it has the first three or four chapters develops this argument, which is classically called the moral argument for the existence of God. And I think it's very powerful. If morals exist, if right and wrong exists, which must be the case for evil to be in the world, then there must be some adequate explanation for that. And it seems like, when you think of the options, the only adequate explanation is the God that people are trying to disqualify when they identify acts of evil.
So we have, it really comes down to asking the atheist, in effect, by what standard, and ergo, where does this standard come from, are you judging any act to be wrong, out of place, unjust, unfair, or evil.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. Where does that standard come from? Now, here are the moves that people might use. They might say, well, it comes from society. But, of course, now when they've said that, they've just sacrificed their objection. Because when you say the standard comes from society, you're really just identifying a certain type of relativism. You're saying there is no objective standard of evil. They're just what people agree in any given society, and societies differ. But, of course, if morality is relative, then, like relative to a society in that situation, well, then it's not objective, and there's no real evil in the world. There are just different societies that have different points of view. So this isn't going to do. The other move is to claim that there are morals in the world. These are real features of the world, moral obligations, but they have no explanation. We just discover them as the furniture of the universe. And I think people like Christopher Hitchens, who has written recently against theism and Christianity in particular, has this view. He believes in morality, but he doesn't think you need a God to ground it. He thinks reason or rationality kinds of grounds it. Well, reason doesn't ground it. It may help you discover it, but it doesn't explain it. It doesn't make a thing right and wrong. And I think this is an inadequate response. It just seems that it makes most sense to say if we have an obligation to do something, and that's what morality is, then we have an obligation to someone. We don't have obligations to things, because things can't hold us to our obligations, where people can. And so I think that the best explanation is that a person is the one to whom we are obliged and who we must obey. If there is a transcendent law, then that seems to suggest a transcendent law giver. At least that strikes me as the best explanation for morality, which allows us to object to the problem of evil.
Greg Kokel is our guest. We're talking about the problem of evil. He's president and CEO of Stand to Reason, based in Signal Hill, California, author of a recent article on the problem of evil for the Solid Ground newsletter. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, or issues ETC at KFUO.org. Do we have an ally in this? In that we can appeal to people's natural sense of right and wrong, of guilt, in this respect? I mean, even the atheist, if he wants to be honest, is going to say, "Yeah, there is a real phenomenon in me, wherever it comes from, of moral guilt. Maybe I'm just guilting myself, but it's there nonetheless."
Yeah, maybe I'm just feeling guilty, he might say, but I'm not actually guilty. That's a great observation, Todd. I trade on this all the time. There is not a person who doesn't feel that he has fallen short of the standard of goodness that he knows he ought to keep. Lewis makes this point very clearly. He says there are two things we know about morality. First, it exists. Secondly, we don't keep it. That's the good news and the bad news. And that not keeping it, that violation of the things we ought to do, even if we don't know where it comes from, even if we're not religious, creates in us a feeling. And I address, I mean, 2 years, 3 years ago, I spoke at Berkeley, and I lectured there for two nights in a row. And the first night, I talked about this issue. In fact, I closed with this comment. I said, there's one thing I know that's true about everybody in this audience. You have a bad self-image. And how do I know that? Because everybody does. Everybody looks down inside of themselves and sees something they don't like, something that's twisted and broken, and that twisted, broken thing is moral. In other words, there's something evil that's down there inside of us. Now, we try to keep it from other people, but we can't keep it from ourselves. And what we do, so what I said, asked him, is, what do we call the feeling that we have about this moral brokenness? Well, everybody chimes in pretty much at the same time. We call it guilt. That's the feeling. Now, here's my question I asked them. Why do we feel guilty? I mean, maybe it's society does it. I guess that's up for grabs. We can talk about that. But how about this? Maybe we feel guilty because we are guilty. How about that? Is that in the running? And I think it is in the running. It ought to be for a reasonable thinking person. We feel guilty because we are guilty. And then the answer to guilt, of course, is not denial. That's relativism. The answer to guilt is forgiveness. And this is where Jesus comes in, Todd. And I think that's a little bridge we can use to show people that Jesus satisfies a genuine need that they actually experience.
That meets the worldview standard, which is, because we were talking about with Ken Samples recently about worldviews, and he says, look, one of it is that it meets the genuine needs of real live people.
That's right.
I'm wondering when someone says, okay, I have that sense of guilt, and I'm wondering if this is why so many atheists, and especially those who have come out of atheism into Christianity, will admit after the fact that they spent a lot of time thinking about and trying to erase God from their lives because of that nagging sense of guilt, because they wanted to be free of it.
Yeah, it's hard sometimes to psychoanalyze any particular person, but there have been enough of them that have come out and actually said that themselves. And some who remain atheists, they don't want God messing with their life. They don't want anybody telling them what to do. They don't want to have a sense that they are doing wrong when they follow their own impulses. They want to be autonomous. They want to be free. And isn't that what Paul talks about in Romans chapter 1? He says they suppress the truth in unrighteousness. That is, motivated by their autonomy, their desire to do evil. They loved the darkness rather than light because their deeds were evil, Jesus said in John 3. Motivated by that, they suppress the truth, the obvious truth of God's existence. So I think you're onto something there, Todd.
Greg Kokel is president and CEO of Stand to Reason in Signal Hill, California, and he's author of an article in the Solid Ground newsletter on the problem of evil. Greg, it's always a pleasure. Keep up the good work, and thanks for being our guest.
Thanks, Todd, and I hope you have a great Thanksgiving, and that to your listeners as well.
Yeah, you too.
Thanks.
You can get Greg Kokel's free Solid Ground newsletter by calling 1-800-2-REASON, 1-800-2-REASON, and ask to receive the Solid Ground newsletter. You can also check out the website for Stand to Reason tonight. Just go to ours first, issuesetc.org, click links, and under those links, you'll find a direct link to Greg Kokel and Stand to Reason. The problem of evil is a real problem. See, the answer of Christianity to the problem of evil isn't that, well, there is no problem. We have all the answers. We don't. What do we have? We have genuine comfort in the face of our own moral evil. Greg spoke briefly about it, the forgiveness of sins that is in Jesus Christ. And we have genuine comfort to those who are the victims of what we call that natural evil, those things that happen that we can't explain. And it's all grounded in Christ's sacrifice for us. Pastor Matt Harrison and LCMS World Relief are responding with that touch of mercy and that comfort to victims of natural and man-made tragedies right there in the midst of the problem of evil. LCMS World Relief is an international relief agency concerned with both body and soul. Find out about their efforts around the world at our homepage, issuesetc.org. issuesetc.org, or by calling 1-888-930-4438, 1-888-930-4438, Pastor Matt Harrison and LCMS World Relief. When we come back, I just mentioned Ken Samples and our ongoing conversation with him on worldviews. We're going to put postmodernism to the worldview test. One of the tests is, can you consistently live it? Does it meet the needs that people find in their lives on a daily basis? Postmodernism lets people kind of have their own truth. My truth, your truth, everybody has their own, and no one needs to argue about it because there is no such thing as objective truth. Is that a workable worldview? A lot of people think it is, but can you live it? It's one of the questions we'll answer on the other side of this break. Ken Samples, author of the new book, A World of Difference, Putting Christian Truth Claims to the Worldview Test, will be our guest. You can join us in the last hour, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, or issuesetc@kfuo.org. Tomorrow on the program, boy, it's been a long time since we've talked with him, but I'm anxious to do it again. Hadley Arkus will join us to talk about abortion politics in 2008.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.